VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show, Gen Con 2010 Special, is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Stock is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store. Welcome to The Tome Gen Con 2010 Special Release, straight from the con. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your show host, Jeff Greiner. And in these specials, I'll be releasing recordings from Gen Con during Gen Con 2010. That's right, I'm at Gen Con 2010 right now in a hotel room as I record this. And this is the generic intro that you're going to get to hear at the start of anything that I release during the con. It's generic, so I don't know what this episode's going to be about. It could be a panel recording. It could be an interview. You're going to have to look at the show notes at thetomeshow.com. to find out exactly what's going on here. I'm recording this intro just to let you know generally what's going to be on this episode, and get, that way I can get it out as quickly as possible and don't have to write and record custom intros and what have you while I'm here at the con and trying to run around and get as much information and content as possible. So it's like going to be like you're at the convention, just with a few hour delay. I'll be recording more things than what I could possibly give you directly from the con, and I hope to release that throughout the rest of August 2010 in regular episodes. But some things just can't wait, and I want to get them to you as quickly as possible. You know what else can't wait? Mentioning our sponsor for this Gen Con 2010 special episode. I'm not going to do a pick of the episode for obvious reasons, but you should check out Noble Knight for new game books and old, dice maps or minis, selling books or buying books. Noble Knight can meet all of your gaming needs. After the ad here, you'll be sent directly into, well, whatever it is in this very special episode. Enjoy.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. A huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
I'm a manager and lead developer for D&D. With me is Rich Baker, who is going to take that.
Hi, folks. I'm Rich Baker. I'm the design manager for D&D.
So what we're going to do today, basically, is go over a couple of things, rules elements that we use, or that we had lots of design and development discussions about. We're going to give you a couple examples of those, kind of walk through those a couple kind of quickly, and then after that, we're going to just move on to a Q&A, because I'm sure you guys have a lot more questions about D&D that we can hopefully provide the answers to. So that's what we're here for. We're going to talk a little bit about character themes. Has anybody here seen the Dark Sun book yet? One? Okay. A couple people? It's awesome. You should all get one as soon as you can. Rodney out there says, yes, it's awesome. It's great. Rodney Thompson, everybody. The character themes are a new concept we introduced in Dark Sun. We'll talk a little bit about where we came up with them, how these guys came up with them, and where they ended up when we were done, and some of the mechanics associated with that. We're going to talk a little bit about Gamma World. Even though we work on Dungeons & Dragons, we also work on other role-playing game systems that are based in Dungeons & Dragons, like the Gamma World game, which is coming out sometime.
October, I think.
October, yes, and I think now, too. And then we'll touch a little bit on the D&D Essentials line, which is the new set of products coming out in September.
Yes.
See, I know one. And we'll talk a little bit about the some of the concepts of Essentials and the classes of Essentials and what we're doing with those books. And then we'll have the Q&A. So that's that. We're going to start with character themes, and I'm going to let Rich take it from here.
Okay. Basically, our idea here is that in the seminar, we do want to just try and give you guys a little bit of a peek behind the curtain to try and explain a little bit of what we do and why we do it. So the first example we have here is the notion of character themes, which are debuting in the Dark Sun campaign guide. A character theme For those of you guys who haven't really seen it yet, is essentially it's a little bit like the character kits from second edition D&D, if you any of you guys remember that, in that it's sort of a third piece of your character identity. It's a for example, you have race, class, and then theme. So you know, race might be elf, class might be ranger, theme might be wasteland nomad, or dune trader, or gladiator, right? These are all very different roles that put a very different spin on your character beyond just a simple identity of your race and class. The reason we decided to go with an idea like themes, because we set off when we first set out to design Dark Sun, our first initial discussions rotated around the idea of describing unique Athasian characters via the same lens of character builds and different class options that we basically used before with like Eberron and Forgotten Realms. And we hit a roadblock early on in that the darn gladiator kept jumping up in our face, and we just didn't know what to do with it. An obvious answer would have been just to create a gladiator class, and in fact we had very long, prolonged arguments and discussions about whether or not we should just do the gladiator as a martial controller class. But the sort of irreducible argument that kept coming up with like the gladiator was, so what is a gladiator? And chances are, 99% of the time, it's going to be a guy who fights in the arena. Well, who fights in the arena, right? Is it only gladiators, or can other people fight in the arena too? And it's like, well, no. You know, fighters might fight in the arena, and battle mines, and rogues, and rangers, and very unhappy wizards. You know, whoever gets thrown into the arena would probably be considered a gladiator. And once we hit that sort of logical hang-up, we say, well, all right, well, hang on. What's another way to skin this particular cat? Because clearly we have something here that's a concept that could extend across several different classes and be appropriate for a wide variety of characters. And we realized we were dealing with something that was not just a single class or even something that you would want to multi-class into and thereby lose out on options for taking other multi-classes, right? Just so you could say, hey, I'm a gladiator because, look, I'm half gladiator. I got the gladiator multiclassing feats, or I'm a hybrid gladiator or something like that. We basically wanted to say, no, anybody who finds themselves in this situation should be able to have this character be part of their character identity. And that really opened up a tremendous amount of design space for us once we started saying, well, what else would be like gladiator? What set of things could you come up with that would be other options about that same scale? And that's where we started hitting ideas like a dune trader. Well, okay, probably a rogue, but, you know, anybody who works for a merchant house or crosses the desert or is busy, you know, involved in trying to make a living by, you know, being a trader in the sands of Athas would want to call themselves a dune trader. Templar. Templar, you know, might be a cleric, but it might also be like a warlock or a wizard, somebody who's basically one of the Sorcerer King's you know, chosen, favored minions to kind of go out and enforce his will. A warlord might be a Templar, right? The guy who essentially is a commander in one of the Sorcerer King's army. All these sorts of things started to come into focus when we realized that themes needed to be something that could apply to a bunch of different characters. You have any thoughts you want to add on that?
Yeah. Mechanically, when we were looking at themes, we're also trying to figure out how do we allow characters to take powers or feats or something, or paragon paths that are related to their theme without necessarily just giving them a flat upgrade and say, okay, you get everything that you would get as a fighter, but then here are also these gladiator things you can do every round and give you another 5 powers or something. We are concerned about things like what we call hand size, but really it's the number of powers you have to keep track of, whether it's you're using power cards or whether you've got them printed off on your character sheet or written down even. You know, the more powers you get, the harder it is to figure out, or at least the more time it takes to figure out what it is you want to do every round. So that was one consideration. Then also, how do we, if we're going to do things like powers, and we talked early on in the process about getting what amounts to a power replacement scheme, kind of like multiclassing is, where you can take, in multiclassing, you can take a feat to swap out one of your powers for a multiclass power. You swap out your third level wizard power for your rogue third level power. We're doing the same kind of thing here, and we also actually did this in skill powers in Player's Handbook 3, where we're just giving you options. If you're a gladiator, here are some powers at the various levels that you can take. You can say, well, I want to take the gladiator power as my third level attack power. So you have that option, and you can select it. It doesn't increase the number of powers you have to play with, but it does give you a broader array of options to choose from when you're building your character. So we worked that in. We looked at how to acquire the theme. One of the discussions was, should this, in effect, initially, which I'll get to in the next slide here, this is sort of a look at how the themes, or parts of the themes evolved. Initially, these were going to be feat buy-ins, where you say, well, I'm going to be a gladiator, and so I'll take the gladiator feat, or in this case, this is the Templar theme, so I'll take the Templar-themed feat, which is Hand of the King, and it would give me a bonus of some sort, and then also I get this feat power. And this was, of course, changed a little bit. We decided, well, it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to go through most of your career and then decide, because you're taking a feat at 12th level, that suddenly you're a Templar. That might make sense in some characters, obviously, but we wanted it to be part of the early experience in Dark Sun to say, you know what, I am a gladiator, I am a Templar, I am a Doom Trader. So we're just giving you the power in Dark Sun. We figure that not only has Dark Sun set a precedent for characters that are a little bit higher power level, but we're giving you something that's a little bit better than an at-will power, but not really necessarily on par with all of your encounter powers in terms of output. And we're just saying, you know what, you can select this power and you have that. And then we make it scale so that it goes up, gets a little better as you go up in level. So that was the evolution. We essentially take this thing that was a feat buy-in. We instead say, make it part of character creation. Make it that third leg that we're talking about, where you have your class, your race, and then you choose your theme as part of that creation.
Is the intent that themes will be used outside of Dark Sun, or are you really expecting that people are just going to use them on Dark Sun?
We do have some ideas of use. I'm pretty loud anyway, but
yeah, it's for the recordings.
Yes, I know. We do have some expectation that themes are a pretty cool bit of technology. We want to use them. We want to make sure that they come to core D&D pretty quickly. So we have some ideas in mind about how we're going to debut those. I just can't talk about them quite yet. However, if you come to the D&D preview seminar on Saturday, I would not be surprised if that came up.
What he said. Another thing you'll notice here, a mechanical change, a small development thing that we did with the themes, is the initial design shows, I mean, you got this attack power that you get to use, which is, you know, sort of cool, but you notice the ability scores are tied to specific ability scores, right? That the idea was, well, the Templar would be geared toward specific character classes initially, and the ability scores typically mapped those. But ultimately we decided, well, we don't really want to have too many restrictions on what you're choosing as your theme. If you decide that the Wizard Gladiator is really what you want to play, we don't want that character to be burdened essentially by an attack power that's based on con, dex, and strength when your int is your best stat. So in this case, your primary ability modifier becomes your attack stat, right? It's just make it as good as the rest of the powers you have. So if you're a gladiator and you're a wizard, you have at least one power that's as good as your wizard powers.
It does say constitution, wisdom, charisma here, but then over on the other side it just says your primary stat.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
that's
this
right.
is a before and after.
Yeah, the before is
yeah.
on the
okay.
left side and the after is on
I
the right side.
I don't pay attention.
Yeah.
That's all right. It's Gen Con, it's all good.
But that's a little glimpse into themes, a little bit of how they change. I mean, there's a lot of... one of the things that actually happened with Dark Sun is we had the developers and the designers working together. Rodney Thompson spent a lot of time working with Rich on making sure that this stuff came in very clean. So by the time we really got into the development cycle for it, a lot of the mechanics have been settled down, and we were really able to focus on the story of, you know, what each of these themes were going to be and make sure we picked, what, 10 or 12?
10.
10 really cool themes. And then there's Gamma World. We're going to have another seminar on Gamma World directly, I guess, tomorrow. When are you?
Rich is, I believe it's that. Saturday.
Or Saturday. That's
Gamma
right.
Yep.
It's in the schedule somewhere. And it's our new game. It's based on the D&D system. If you know how to play D&D, then you'll know how to play this. It differs in a couple of ways. We don't have a book full of classes and powers you select for your classes. You just roll what random themes you're going to be. If you're going to be a cockroach android, and that's what you roll, then that's what you are. Game World's kind of fun that way. But because we built it within the context of the D&D game system, it's interoperable with D&D. You can take your D&D monsters if you need another encounter to throw in for your Gamma World game, you can just pull stuff out of the monster manual. And vice versa, if you want to take Gamma World monsters and have, irradiated androids running through your D&D game, then you can do that as well. But they use the same core mechanics, and we were able to explore some game design ideas within Gamma World that are less traditional, I guess, for D&D. But and then we have an integrated card mechanic in there as well. You get decks of cards with the base set that provide random powers your characters can use during and the treasure that they gain during the encounters. But more on that at Rich's seminar. We want to talk a little bit about one of the mechanical aspects we did here in Gamma World. Initially, we were, of course, using our standard array. This is, again, before and after, by the way. The before is on the top, and the after is on. Okay, we got it. The initial design was very much like D&D. You pick your ability scores, you assign them. The way that your character generation works right now is you roll random on a table of 20 different possible mutations, right? Or 19, 20?
It's actually 21.
Oh, 21. Okay. Well, yeah. If you roll doubles, you get 21.
Yeah.
So you roll on the table, and that determines what your sort of core character is, whether you're part plant or part android or engineered human or whatnot.
Pyrokinetic. Seismic.
All those things.
Yeah.
And you get powers associated with that. As you go up in level, based on your level, you get the attack powers and so on that really make you feel like you're part of that theme. But we made you initially just roll your or assign your ability scores using the standard array and say, okay, well, figure out what your best stat should be and probably put your 16 in that stat. And that means that your second theme probably doesn't look as good because it's got a 14 in it. And we decided that that actually wasn't as fun as just saying, you just get an 18 in your first stat. Your first role is android, okay, you're 18 for intelligence. Is that android? I don't remember.
Could be. I don't recall off the top of my head.
And your second theme is seismic, so you get a 16 in con. From if you roll something that shares the same ability score, if you're an intelligent, android scientist guy, then you'd get a 20 because both of them are associated with int. And for your rest of your ability scores, you pick up 3d6 and you roll them in order, and you write down the numbers just like we used to do back in the 80s. That's sort of one evolution.
Yeah. I'm going to jump in now. Okay.
Yeah. You do that.
So you might remember back in the old day with Gamma World that your character had a certain amount of mutations and a certain amount of disadvantageous mutations. And we didn't really want to clutter up the book with a whole lot of disadvantageous mutations and force you to take things like you take damage from sunlight or weapons do double damage against you or horrible things like that that are really kind of a beating. I was not real nuts about this idea because, I was obviously when I designed it, I designed the first one. But the thing that swayed me over on the idea of, you ought to just roll the other ability scores that you probably don't care about much is, if you happen to throw a 5 in dexterity, clearly you have a disadvantage. Maybe you got an 18 in dexterity and you didn't need it. Maybe you got a 5 in dexterity, and now you're just taking -3 on all sorts of things you wish you weren't taking -3 on, like balancing and ranged attacks and things like that. So we felt that this is actually kind of a fun way to say, you know, you're going to have your core mutations that really kind of define your character. And then there's going to be a whole bunch of other stuff that you might be great at and you might be terrible at and you're probably just average at. And that was the thing that kind of brought me over and around to this idea. The interesting thing about Gam World, by the way, is we had a stage in Gam World where we actually had a character class template that got slapped on top of your mutations so that you would, for example, say, hey, I roll once, I've got the seismic power set. I roll twice, I've got the cockroach power set. I guess I'm a seismic cockroach. That's kind of gross, but that's what I am. And then you would slap on top of that your idea of, I want to be a defender. So because I'm a defender, I should get extra healing surges. I should get more hit points. I should get more stuff like that. Or I slap on the leader template because everyone knows you should follow seismic cockroaches. And you would get like a healing word power, and you would get like an ability to help people out and do some target designation type powers. Stuff that we normally would associate with the leader theme. The leader role. But we realized that was actually creating a set of complications that just didn't need to exist. That we could actually roll, when I say roll in this case, I mean gather in. We could bring a lot of that stuff in together simply into the mutation power sets, the mutation themes, and say, you know, if you're seismic, you're going to be big and rocky and tough, and you're going to be hard to get away from because you're going to make earthquakes around you. You're kind of defenderish. Let's just make the seismic power set a very good defender power set and let that just be the way you determine, you know, what you're doing in the party. In Gamma World, because everyone has access to ranged weapons like fusion rifles and black ray pistols and things like that, and everyone has potentially access to mutations that are great in melee combat or great in ranged combat, there's a lot less difference between the character roles than there would be in D&D. It's not really clear that somebody should be the guy who's on point and somebody should be the guy who's hanging back and doing stuff at a distance. We were willing to let that be more determined by kind of the luck of the draw, and that's where that's essentially where we got to letting an initial notion that we had in design just kind of fall out and say it's just not really part of what we need to do here.
I'll give it back to you. Right. I just had a turn.
All right. Just to talk a few minutes about the Essentials products. The Essentials products, starting in September, will provide new builds for the classic D&D archetypes that we're all familiar with, the cleric, the fighter, the wizard, the rogue. While they might have slightly different power acquisition in some cases, you might have seen that on the previews for the Slayer and the Thief, or no, the Knight and the Thief that have been online in the last few weeks, and then I guess the Slayer's going up this Friday. They still fit within the framework of our existing Player's Handbook classes, and they have a very level of complexity. They have simple, not simple classes, but a reduced number of powers for classes like the Slayer and the Knight, where you don't have to track a larger number of daily attack powers and encounter attack powers. You're able to just use your power strike and your at-will stances as your decision-making on a turn-by-turn basis. And we can contrast that with something like the Wizard or the Cleric, which follow more of our traditional Player's Handbook style power acquisition, where they have encounter attack powers, daily attack powers, utility powers, and a lot of different choices they can make from round to round. And it allows for a range of complexity. You can decide to play a class that's a little simpler or a class that's more complex, but you're still as powerful as each other, essentially. That's our goal with that. We're also trying to make the game a little easier to pick up for new players. If you have a new player in your group or if you want to get new players in your group, the Essentials products are a great way to introduce them to D&D. That's not to say that they are only for new players. There's a lot of really cool stuff in these that might be more appealing to advanced players. One of my playtesters said that he really likes the Slayer and wants to play that over many of the other classes we have. Even though it's a simpler class, he likes the the approach that we take. It's very thematic and interesting that way. Can I say anything? Go for it.
With the idea that the character complexity, just to kind of keep beating on this a little bit, certainly it was the case in like first edition, second edition, even third edition, that the fighter was sort of the training wheels class, right? That was the one, somebody's in your game for the first time, you don't hand off the 10th level mage and say, you know, start here, right? You'd be like, here, just play the fighter, right? You're going to make a couple attacks around, you're going to do some damage, try to get in the monster's grill if you can, right, and keep him from beating on the mage, because that's the important guy. But in 4th edition, we lost some of that ability to have a class that could serve as a good stepping stone for the starting player, right? It was the complexity load to play a 4th edition fighter is almost exactly the same as the complexity load to play a 4th edition wizard. I mean, wizards are a little bit more complex because they tend to have more multi-target guys, multi-target effects, and they tend to do more conditions. But by and large, the same sorts of decisions you're being made each time. By taking a look at what can we do to take a couple of classes like the rogue, like the fighter, pull them back a little bit, and let them just be what people kind of expect and want them to be. In the first place, yeah, it's great for new players. In the second place, I think it's also really good for experienced players who simply want to kind of devote their mental resources to something different than tracking the encounter powers and the daily powers that right now you're paying a lot of attention to. It lets you concentrate on things like role-playing, on decision-making, and get a little bit less tactical in some ways and think approach a game from a different way. I guess that's about all I got to say on that. I'm just going to talk myself into a circle, but keep up.
Sure. You want to address this one?
Oh, yeah. This is the other big part of Essentials, which one of the other things we wanted to do in designing Essentials is we wanted to start to try to drive the creation of game artifacts like spells, like powers, like feats, more from a lens of story rather than pure mechanical niche. So as an example of something that we've made an effort to do in the Essentials process, we said, hey, when we introduce a power like Lightning Bolt, let's actually tell you a little bit about Lightning Bolt, right? Let's actually put a bit of flavor text up front to explain what it is, what it's for, when you use it, and be able to actually have that sort of explication that would have happened like two editions ago, right? First edition, second edition. That stuff would have been buried in the body of the spell description, and you wouldn't really know if you're looking at rules text or if you're looking at just general theory about what it's supposed to be doing. In third edition, early fourth edition, we tended to pull that stuff out of the spell text and either put it in flavor text like this. We started doing it towards the end of third edition and obviously through fourth edition. But even then, we were extremely careful to try to avoid saying things in the spell that could be construed as anything other than a rule, because we didn't want to have people say, well, look, it says here it turns this guy into a harmless animal, so, you know, what's that mean? You know, and as much as we like to say, and I'm thinking like Baleful Polymorph here, right, as an example, right? As much as we like to be able to say, it's a harmless animal. Come on, guys. It's like, you know, it's whatever. It can't hurt you. You know, now people are saying, well, what if I put the frog into a cannon and fired it at the guy? You know, with that, it's harmless, right? Would it hurt him or not? It's like, no, that was theory about saying frogs are generally harmless, unless, of course, you put them in cannons. You know? But by and large, the kind of story-based of focus would let us be able to say something like, hey, you know, Baleful Polymorph, you turn something into a harmless animal that couldn't, you know, normally bite you or poison you or do whatever to you. And we can put that sort of information into discussion and sort of the theory and the thinking behind the spell, its place in the world, what it's supposed to do and why it's there. We can get into that a bit more just with a simple change in format and by kind of telling you, let's drive this through what makes a good story and what makes a good piece of the world rather than what's simply filling the niche of, hey, we need a level 7 attack power. Is it level 7?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, good. That was a good guess on my part. I wasn't even looking. that's going to do X amount of damage and this many targets, and it's going to be electricity damage, so I guess it's Lightning Bolt. So this is a place where we're taking trying a somewhat new direction in how we approach designing our products. You want to say anything more on that? I mean, how can you beat frogs and cannons?
I can't beat frogs and cannons. A quick question back there.
Yeah, I actually really like this format. I think we can only give more information to both the players and the DMs. But I'm just curious, since there's already bulk material out there for the core edition and everything, are you planning to do this going forward with the standard D&D set, or is this just for essentials?
Moving ahead in terms of our format, we are going to be doing more things. Microphone? Sorry.
I didn't repeat the question.
Oh, okay. Okay, so the question is, are we going to be using this format going ahead in D&D products that are outside the Essentials line? And the short answer is, yeah, we want to move in this direction heading forward so that when we do things that that are like additional players' handbooks, players' option books, things like that, we want people to have this sort of approach and this sort of thinking about DDR articles, for example. We want people to have exposure to this sort of thinking about the power. We want to, this is a place where we're actually changing our design philosophy a bit. Whether we would actually go back in time and start trying to do this approach for like everything we already published up to this point, probably not. That's a ton of powers and feats and things that we'd have to try and do that for. And it would be difficult to figure out what the right venue to deliver that to you guys is.
In the case of a few powers and feats, for example, Lightning Bolt, this came right out of the Essentials book that's coming out in September. So it is mostly like the version that came out of Player's Handbook. There are a couple of key differences. Sure, we can take questions.
Are the powers that are going to be published in the Essentials book, would they be appropriate to be taken by the similar classes in the other books? Would a regular 4th edition wizard be able to take this Essentials?
So the question is, will characters that are not Essentials characters be able to take the powers that are listed in the Essentials books? And the answer is absolutely. In this case, we've updated a number of wizard powers, but every wizard power in that book, there might be a couple like utility powers that we're providing for the Essentials wizard that don't have a level associated with them. They're things that resemble rituals, basically, because of a... I don't know how much we said about the mage. I'm looking at Bill. He's...
I'll keep going. If I throw something at you, you'll shut up.
All right.
Our boss is here, which is, of course, no pressure at all for us.
For example, the mage doesn't have rituals the same way the wizard has rituals, but he has some powers that look a lot like rituals you're familiar with. Those powers don't have levels. They're not as utility powers. They are not things that a wizard could take at any of his slots. This, however, is a wizard attack 7. It is available to any wizard who is 7th level and wants to use this power in a 7th level slot or add it to a spellbook. It's also gaining the evocation keyword, which is key for the mage because he uses schools now.
Does this level of simplicity extend through 1 to 30, and what does it mean for Paragon Paths and Epic Destinies?
Design direction is all the way through Epic Tier. We have Paragon Path abilities for every class in the Essentials products and Epic Destiny as well. We'll have more information, I think, about that on Saturday for details. But
Is this information going to be included in the D&D Insider subscriptions, like Character Builder?
These are all D&D powers. Our intent is to put them all available in the appropriate online tools.
Will there be a way to differentiate between whether it's essential power versus non-essential, or is it?
If a power has the same name, for instance, Lightning Bolt, there is shortly going to be no difference between this power and the one that you would look up in the Player's Handbook, in the sense that the Player's Handbook power will be updated to reflect all of these changes. So there will be one Lightning Bolt power is the gist of it. And in the Character Builder and Compendium, and it will indicate where it was changed. It'll say this power was updated in Heroes of the Fallen Lands, and it'll have that text.
Do you foresee a lot of updates like that? I mean, how many powers do you see getting updated between Essentials and the original PHP?
Greg would know for certain. There are a number of powers that are that we picked up from Player's Handbook or from some of the powers books. Arcane Power, for example, I think the Wizard, the Mage has a couple of those, but not all of them have changed. So and some of them we just picked up. This is a good power. Let's use it. Some of them, like Lightning Bolt, we needed to add a keyword to it. We wanted to add half damage on a miss to it. But there are some. I don't know the exact number. Maybe that's something we can get Greg to post or blog about.
I don't know off the top of my head either. Yeah.
Was the real reason to kind of beef up these powers? Because over time they're just going to get beefed up?
So the question is, are we beefing up the powers? And no, more correctly, we are adjusting powers to make sure they fit the curves we want them to. In some cases, we're beefing up powers. We're also nerfing powers occasionally, and we're also just picking them up without change. All right.
Is the success or failure of the Essentials lines going to ultimately kind of dictate the direction of the core products?
That seems like a question for Bill.
That's a great question for Bill.
I wasn't supposed to be on this panel.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Slavicek.
That seems like one I don't want to touch on. Bill sitting in the audience.
I was going to say, the success or failure of these products is the success or failure of our jobs. So.
I think that Rich or Steve said it a little earlier that this is the direction we're going in all products moving forward. So it has nothing to do. We're already going in that direction, success or not. Let me explain really quick what the essentials are for everybody, right? If the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons is a highway, we used to let you get on at exit 10th Street. And that's where the Player's Handbook and the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Monster Manual sit. We've now added an on-ramp at 1st Street. So we've made these essential products. There's 10 of them. They're going to be in bookstores and game stores all the time so that when people come in that want to play the game for the first time, they only see Player's Handbook 2 and number 1 isn't on sale because it's out of stock. So that's the first thing. Essentials is this. It's a marketing tool, first. Or that's one of its uses. Its second use is it's got a bunch of new stuff in it, and that stuff is good for new players and for, you know, the existing fighter is going to want some of the things that the knight or the slayer have, and he can take them, or she. Same with the wizard and the mage. There are certain powers that are specifically for the essential classes, and there's a handful for each class that they can only have them. That will also be true for our builds moving forward. When we build some new class build, that gives us a little more leeway to make that particular build special. Where was I going, and do I need to keep going?
I think you're good.
Did I answer the question? Did I answer the group question? So in general, we expect this to work. We expect that you'll like it better than the previous stuff because it's just giving you better stuff. The other thing, you know, like Rich said, we have changed a few powers. Some got better, some got worse because they were too good. Some didn't change at all, and there's a bunch of new stuff in there too. But it's, you know, if we could have done this as Player's Handbook 4, and you know, there would have been no controversy. So we just changed stuff a little bit, and everybody's up in arms. But it's going to be good. Trust us.
And I guess my big concern is just, is there eventually going to be a hardcover edition that's going to fit with the rest of my collection? Or is this all going to be paperback and whatnot?
And like, that's more a question of success, right? We're doing these as a cheaper entry point.
Right.
If there's a demand for them to be put in a hardcover later, we will do that. But that's not on our... We're not looking to sell you this book twice at the moment or anything like that. We're looking to make a $20 paperback purchase.
Right, and I appreciate that. I understand that.
And you know, it might be that those work so well that we do everything that way. Right? There's the other direction. but right at the moment, we still have plenty of hardcovers that you'll see on my presentation on Saturday. So, and now I'm going to sit here in case they don't need me again.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Over there.
Most of what I think people have heard about the Essentials product line is the different character classes.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of design changes and improvements have you made from the Dungeon Master side?
I'm trying to... The trick to this, to some extent, this is our theme of our seminar is supposed to be design development, where we can kind of give you a little peek behind the curtain. I'm trying to avoid the temptation to tell you about this thing I'm all really enthused about, right? You know, and really get into this. So it's not that I want to deflect questions about essentials or anything. I just kind of want to let them have their proper venue.
And on Saturday, we're going to have people who actually worked on the product.
Yeah.
Steve has, but Rich hasn't yet.
Yeah.
He was busy doing Gamma World and Dark Sun while we were doing the essentials.
Yeah.
So Saturday will be a better venue. That said, if you've got an answer, give it to him.
Yeah, we do have the DM kit coming out, which we'll talk a little bit more about on Saturday.
Okay. I'd say help for skill challenges, I think, is a fair thing to bring up.
Yeah.
You want to repeat that into the mic?
Yeah. I was going to say, like one particular thing I've noticed is, for example, there's a fair amount of help for skill challenges, where I think the organization, the presentation is a little bit better. We've kind of re-examined how hard they are, how many successes, well, how other ways to accumulate successes, things like that, where we want to give the DM a better, more robust tool for including these in his game. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff we have in skill challenges. I mean, I think especially, I guess it was DMG2 provided a bunch of help for him. We wanted to try and codify that and even make it a little bit more easier for the DM to incorporate these things in his game and present the players with different challenges besides, hey, you know, it's another straight-up fight.
Yeah, and actually along the lines of skill challenges, we also recently revisited and revised all of our skill challenge DC stuff, skill DCs, that shows up. I know it's in the rules compendium. I think we've already put it in DMG2. I don't remember.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So it's help. And then the Monster Manual 3 introduced the new monster format, which we think is a better tool for DMs to read monsters and figure out exactly what the monsters can do at the various points, and don't need to see my screensaver. Over here.
With the release of Essentials, is it true that the Player's Handbook will be out of print? Oh. The original Player's Handbook?
No, it's not true. I mean,
good.
The Player's Handbook is, as I said, it's the on-ramp for the higher-end player who doesn't need the extra help.
It's just a rumor. I'm glad it's not true.
I can't say anything about that. Rich's Gamma World presentation has a slide that tops this one easily. So now it's officially Q&A time. Don't know what we've been doing the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But let's go through any questions.
A and queuing.
A and queuing. Any questions you guys have about the design or development of D&D, we can continue to take them.
Had you guys considered leaving the multiple versions of the powers, like the old magic missile and the new magic missile, and maybe just like give them a second name, like the Everett's magic missile or whatever?
Sure. The question is, had we considered in the places especially where we've made drastic changes,
yes,
where magic missile now is completely different than Magic Missile of the Player's Handbook and much more like the Magic Missile of earlier editions, right? but the answer is we wanted Wizards and Mages in the Essentials product to be casting Magic Missile. We wanted that to be, you know, it's sort of iconic, the "I cast Magic Missile" quote that everybody that is a mage uses. We wanted that to be what we felt was the right version of Magic Missile, the one that people should be familiar with, which is I hit a guy for force damage and it hits automatically. It doesn't even hit, it affects automatically. That is an example of a power where it was particularly different from the initial Player's Handbook version. And we would have had to rename the power mostly because of our dependency on our online tools. We can't have powers with the same names in the same class. It causes problems for our database and indexing and stuff. But the we thought about it, but ultimately I'm going to give it to Bill because he wants to say something.
The goal with Essentials 2 was not to make the game more complex, and having 17 magic missile spells in the game is more complex.
Yeah, ultimately, when it comes to a specific power name, it's should the should we use a different power name entirely, in which case we're not using Magic Missile there anymore, or have multiple versions of the same power. We decided we didn't want to have multiple versions of the same power. That's why whenever we do an update, we do an update to every place that power has appeared.
How long did it take from the point you decided to do something simpler for the newer player before you got to this point? How long is this development cycle for something like that? Because
it's about a year.
About a year, that's pretty. So I mean, had the decision been made, had you already known you were going to do it last Gen Con, or was it something that came out of that, or...
That's a good question.
So the question was whether we knew we were going to do this a year ago. About what time did we start? I guess there's really two answers. What time did we start thinking about it, and what time did we actually put it on the schedule, and when did we start working on it? Three questions. Now it's three questions.
I mean, a lot of this was actually being thought of as we were doing the original design of 4th edition. We put stuff out the way we thought was the right way, and we saw, we watched what was going on, and while we were happy with it, we also saw that we weren't quite where we wanted to be for, I think I mentioned this last year, our next stage was acquisition, right? Our first stage was introducing the new game, bringing people over from previous editions, and then we were going to get into acquisition of growing the marketplace. We felt we were not quite in the place we needed to be to grow the marketplace. So I think the decision was actually made shortly after last year's Gen Con to start incorporating design that we'd already actually had in the can, and then we just started working from there.
Alex?
Can you talk about the name of this is design and development, and what does that mean? What's the difference between design, what's the difference between development, why do you do design and development? I think for anybody who's sort of worked in game design, there isn't a bifurcation. You just make up a game, and then you play test it for a little while, and then you try to sell it. But how does Wizard go about this, and why?
It's a trade secret. No.
So the question is, what's the difference between design and development? Design is the original iteration of the concept that we're working on. If you were to kind of trace a product's lifetime, usually it starts as an idea which might be, not that we would do this, right, but I'm just going to throw out an idea for purpose of the illustration here. We might have a concept like elf book. We want to do a book about elves, all good elf stuff. Usually that appears in our planning anywhere from like 1 to 3 years out. I mean, sometimes we have shorter horizons where we're actually saying, let's just fill out what we think next year's schedule is going to need. And other times we're implementing or just brainstorming longer-term plans. But products will usually appear with just a very short hook or tag where we don't even really know what the contents are of Elf Book other than the fact that, well, presumably it's about elves, right? When we get a little bit closer in where it's kind of time to start working on it, right, and once again, an idea might sit in the schedule sit out kind of on our list of possible products, might sit there for a couple of years before we actually get to it, or it might be something that we say, elf book, oh, why don't we think of an elf book? Get on that tomorrow, and let's get cracking. From the moment we say, okay, seriously, we're going to assign resources and start working on it, a designer or a team of designers, depends on how long the project is. We usually be working on concepting out what's going to be in the first step is that there's going to be a set of concept meetings where we get a bunch of people together and brainstorm, okay, what could be in an elf book? What sorts of things do we think we might want to include? Are there any new mechanics we think we want to debut? Are there any new story elements we want to make sure we include? Out of those concept meetings, we'll create a product outline, which, you know, could be anywhere from a couple of pages to, like, you know, 15 or 20 pages. Depends on how much we know about, how much stuff we want to annotate, how much stuff we want to describe. That product outline is normally going to be created anywhere from about a year to maybe a year and a half before the product is actually going to be released. Once we have that outline in hand, then we're going to assign designers to begin designing it. Designing it really means taking everything that's in the outline and elaborating on it. We might have said something in the outline like, hey, we think we want to include about 6 or 8 good elf paragon paths. Well, the designer is going to sit there and look at that and say, okay, what are good elf paragon paths we could do here? He might go back to the notes from the concept meeting about things that were batted around. He might just kick it around, ideas around the office about what would make good paragon paths. A lot of times he'll just sit there and you know, look out a window and take a pad of paper, which might be the way I do it, and just think about, start listing out what sounds like it would be cool ideas for paragon paths, and start winnowing it down to something you can actually write on. But by and large, the designer is the guy who takes it from the outline stage into something that begins to approach what you get on your end, which is it's going to be a document of about the same length of the final product that hopefully touches on everything we decided we wanted to touch on, and covers the basic concept of the book. At various stages, he's going to be kicking around, touching base with people like, hey, I'm introducing new mechanics. Let's playtest some of these. Let's brainstorm some more about these. Let's bring in a developer to have a look at this particular new mechanic and make sure we're going the right way. But essentially, design is literally creating the 40 or 50,000 words that are going to be printed eventually. After the designer wraps up, he moves it over. The book will go into development. Sometimes it goes into development right away. Sometimes, depending on our scheduling windows, it might go into development a couple of months later. But I think that's a good point to pass the mic over to Steve.
So when I get the mic and the files, I basically have to evaluate what's there, read through the book, and determine what parts are essentially the most rough. There's a mechanical pass as well as a story pass. We focus more on the development team with the mechanics of the book, making sure they fit, making sure they accurately convey the story. If the story is cool enough, then the mechanics hopefully will follow out of that. Most of our work is reviewing those mechanics and figuring out what is fitting and what isn't fitting in the book. If there are sections of the book that need to be redone, then we'll work with the designers to get new material there, or we will sometimes be writing that new material. But essentially it's the mechanical pass of the book there. We determine if the powers are functioning. Are they going to break the game when they go out there? Or are they even interesting, right? Is it cool? Does it work? Those are the questions we ask in development and try to make the book as good as it can be before we get it off to the editors and get editing and managing editing and that sort of final pass. But even though it is a staged process where we have a design phase and then we move into a development phase, that really indicates the ownership of the book. We also have a lot of back and forth. I mentioned like with the Dark Sun book, we had one of our developers working with the design team throughout most of that design stage in order to make sure that the mechanics were as solid as possible coming through. So when we started addressing it during the development phase, there were more ironing out the smaller wrinkles as opposed to perhaps overhauling the themes, for example. I think that process works very well.
One way to think about design is that that's the place where we think really far outside the box. We try to stretch the game in all directions. And then development is a refinement, and it puts it back in the box in some regards. Not all the way, but to make sure that we haven't gone too far.
It moves the box.
It moves the box a little bit, make sure we didn't go too far. And it's an iterative process that makes every product we do better. And one of the things I think is so wonderful about working on a team like we have at Wizards is that it's not one person by themselves coming up with a great idea. It's a team of people making a great idea even better. And that's what happens through design, development, and editing.